Welcome to News and Brews. I'm Mike Heslin.
And I'm Meryl Yabuke. And this week, we have a special guest, James Torito, the international methane hunter. James has a very interesting day job, but very relevant to this week's episode. He spent the last week in Glasgow at COP26, where, I don't know, Mike, I think there was pretty significant progress, at least on the methane reduction front.
Yeah, it's really interesting. The whole interview is fascinating, but to hear about meaningful concrete progress on methane, which I had no idea how significant of a lever it is in the fight against climate change. We also have some kind of good news this week on both infrastructure and the economy that we'll get into.
And some not so good news coming out of Ethiopia, which couldn't have avoided that one. Things are really going south very quickly there.
But a lot to unpack there that you did an expert job of explaining.
Well, thanks. I think it's, you know, there's a lot of nuance and acronyms, but, you know, we tried to distill it for folks. And look, I think the ending with the interview with James was the perfect way to recap what happened in Glasgow and what is continuing to happen. So really happy to have him on.
All right, let's get into it.
Let's do it.
Hey, Harold.
Hey, Mike. How are you? It's good to see you.
Great to see you too.
Yeah. And we're seeing another friend of ours, James Torito, on. James, thanks for joining.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Mike, we've got a lot to talk about this week, but before we talk about this week, can we talk about your week? How was your week?
My week's been great. You know, we're like into the rhythm of fall now.
I love fall. I'm sure people are on like, you know, bated breath on Achilles injury updates, but like I'm actually walking now.
Nice.
And yeah, so I've really been getting out and enjoying it. And I had my first solo stove fire pit shenanigans on Saturday, and it was everything I hoped for and more. And
beautiful.
All the haters joined and had a really good time themselves.
How was the time change for you? We fell back this weekend.
Yeah, I think James, y'all fell back last week. So you've had time. Also, you don't have kids. It was pretty bad, I'm going to go ahead and say. Softened a little bit by the fact that we have a grandmother in town. God bless her. You know, she bore the brunt of the attack at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, that'll help. The only thing to really blunt the attack for us is that my 2.5-year-old decided to stop napping starting this weekend. So she was tired anyway. Not that that always leads to more sleep, but it was something.
That's awesome. Well, I want to give James a quick introduction, and then maybe we can talk about what we're all collectively drinking, which is, spoiler alert, a couple of us have non-beers today. Is that, that's allowed on News and Brews, right?
As long as it's topical.
As long as it's topical. Okay. So James, really appreciate you coming on. You know, obviously we're all friends from the Juba days of yore, but you have a long and storied history of basically turning hobbies into lifelong passions and sometimes even gainful employment. The other thing is, like Mike and me, you seem to have married up, but unlike Mike and me, you and your wife get to live in Berlin, which is pretty cool. You're a rugby player, ultra marathon, mountain race runner person, beer brewer, and literal Renaissance man. And so today you have, and the reason that you're on the show, in addition to being a friend of the show, is that you have one of the coolest job titles ever, which is campaign manager for super pollutants at the Clean Air Task Force. And so you're basically a climate superhero as far as I can tell. But we're really happy to have you on and would love to hear what you're drinking, first of all, before you like drop some, you know, climate truth on us.
Yeah, so I'm drinking the Brau Manufacturer Potsdamer Strange. It's kind of a local beer-ish, like Potsdam is about half hour south of Berlin. And it's quite good. It's like a Hefeweizen. It's, you know, organic. And I think the brewery is pretty new, which is something new in Germany. They don't have too many new breweries. A lot of their beer is about 500 years old. But it's one of the beers that I found when I first moved here, and it's something I've enjoyed.
Excellent beer name too, the Potsdamer Strange. So Errol, you and I have a bit of a theme in honor of our Glasgow discussion today, of today being a news and scotch episode. So I've got the Glenfiddich 12. It's a staple. It also happened to be the only scotch in my house, but it's a great excuse to bring my We the People glass, nice, which I'll hold up for great like video content just for us, that has the text of the Constitution on it in my rocks glass.
Super strong. So I actually am one of those people that has multiple Scottish whiskeys. If you go to Scotland and you try to call it scotch, they will correct you. It is in Scotland, it is just whiskey. So I have multiple whiskeys of the Scottish variety. And I did a Google map search of like which distillery was closest to Glasgow. And in my collection, at least, turns out it's Oban. So I'm rocking the Oban 14, which is a single malt from the West Highlands. And it is definitely a go-to in this household. And by the view of the bottle, needs to be replenished here relatively soon.
Is it closer than where Wolf Blitzer was in comparison to Glasgow?
Or right. Glasgow, or as Wolf Blitzer calls it, Edinburgh.
Edinburgh. Yes. I didn't map that, but I probably should have. The Edinburgh Castle in the back was really pretty when he was on TV, though. So what do you say, Mike? Should we get into the first round?
Let's get into it. Our first round story this week is actually a really big one, because after more than 4 years, spanning two presidencies, three congresses, and at least two violent and deadly right-wing rallies, Infrastructure Week has finally come to an end.
Has it, though?
Maybe it's just beginning. But the House of Representatives on Friday night passed the $1 trillion Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, also known as the Bipartisan Infrastructure Framework, which will now go to President Biden's desk for signature. So I thought we could talk about first just how it came together, how this passed. Then we'll get into what's actually in the bill that they passed. So how it came together. The bill had passed the Senate in August with broad bipartisan support, including from Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. But in the House Minority Leader and noted resting deer in the headlights face, Kevin McCarthy, pushed his caucus to vote against the measure, hoping to derail both the infrastructure bill and the broader Build Back Better Act, which is Biden's broader economic and climate package. That one has an estimated investment of $1.75 trillion at this point. Still, not all the deer were willing to follow Leader McCarthy into the headlights, and 13 Republicans voted for the bill, which was more than enough to offset the 6 Democrats who voted against it, and the bill ended up passing 228 to 206.
This is a really interesting part of the story, Mike. Like, the fact that they peeled off 13 Republicans and were able to thus call it the bipartisan infrastructure deal is actually a pretty big deal.
Well, and I think the bipartisan moniker really came from the Senate, where it got like 69 votes and was, you know, including McConnell, was very much bipartisan.
Yep.
And it became this kind of strategic shift. But I do think it's interesting that, like, you know, those of us who were paying attention 10 years ago in the Obama administration and, you know, in the Paul Ryan led congressional GOP, we're used to every single Republican voting in lockstep every single time.
Yeah.
And so I do think it's meaningful that there were 13 Republicans who voted for this bill. But looking at the 6 Democrats who voted against it, I think is where some of the interesting story comes out here. So those 6 Democrats were progressive members of the so-called squad, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Cori Bush, and Jamal Bowman. As of Friday afternoon, so remember this bill passed Friday night. As of Friday afternoon, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, who's the leader of the House Progressive Caucus, was saying plainly and publicly that progressives were ready to vote down the bill with 30 members opposed to it.
Mm.
And over the weekend, the New York Times put out a really well-reported story, which came from Jonathan Weissman and Carl Hulse, basically walking step by step through how they got from 30 opposed down to 6 to be able to pass this bill. And the rub was, as we've discussed extensively on News and Brews, progressives didn't want to vote for the infrastructure bill without Build Back Better out of concern that more conservative Democrats would withhold support on the Build Back Better Act if they already had the infrastructure bill in their pocket.
Right. So again, they didn't oppose what was in the legislation. It was that they just wanted their cake and the ability to eat it.
Exactly. Yes. And the compromise, which was brokered by the Congressional Black Caucus, in addition to Pelosi's leadership team, was to couple passage of the infrastructure bill with a vote on the rules of debate for the Build Back Better bill, including committing to a vote the week of November 15th. So next week, as you're listening to this,
which seems like kind of a concession, but it's actually a pretty big deal. Like you're committing to vote on the rules, which means it's moving forward. There's like a date at which it moves forward.
So the date is important, although are they really going to hold it up any longer than it needs to? What I do think is meaningful is, on top of this, a group of conservative House Democrats led by Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey wrote a letter to their more progressive colleagues committing to vote for the Build Back Better Act in its current form with only technical changes, as long as the Congressional Budget Office confirms what the White House has said about the bill being paid for.
Okay.
So this combination, exactly. And this combination of concessions plus hard lobbying from the White House, Pelosi, and leaders of the Congressional Black Caucus was enough to whittle that dissent from progressives down from 30 to 6. And so this basically puts the House in the same place as the Senate on the Build Back Better bill. You've got Josh Gottheimer in the House. You've got coal millionaire Joe Manchin in the Senate, both saying they're waiting for the CBO to score this, to say what the actual impact on the deficit will be before they commit to supporting it, but that otherwise they're basically on board.
Yeah. So this passed the House. Does it need to like repass the Senate, or is there a like reconciliation process?
No, they passed, I guess, you know, the news reports all said that this is now going to Biden's desk for signature. So I guess they passed the bill in the same form that it passed the Senate back in August.
Got it. Okay, cool.
So what's actually in the bill?
Anything on climate?
There is, as a matter of fact, and maybe James will have more to add on that, but in total, the bill includes $1.2 trillion in infrastructure investments, some of which is a continuation of prior commitments, but $550 billion of which is brand new spending. And of that $550 billion, $110 billion is for roads, bridges, and other surface transportation. $39 billion is to modernize public transit systems, which is the largest ever federal investment in public transit, and in itself is really meaningful in terms of moving toward more climate-friendly modes of transportation. $66 billion is going to Amtrak, including high-speed rail and upgrades to the Northeast Corridor.
You know that had to be in there.
Oh, for sure. Biden wouldn't have had it any other way.
Yeah, I mean,
going to bat for Amtrak.
Yeah.
$65 billion is to get every American access to high-speed internet, including a $30 a month internet subsidy for 1 in 4 Americans.
Wow.
Another $65 billion is going to upgrade the electric grid, which includes smart grid and the transmission of renewable energy. So this one is a big deal. And this is what I've heard other climate folks say is actually really significant, even though this infrastructure bill, I think, is rightly seen as overall not being sufficient on the climate side.
Yeah. James, what's your take on the bill that just passed?
Yeah, there's a lot in it that's looking good for climate, certainly. There are a few other things I can mention here, too. There's some funding, about $5 billion, for plugging methane leaking from abandoned oil wells, which is a big and growing problem. There's some funding towards hydrogen hubs, which is a lot of people see as going to be a need to take over heavier duty transportation and airplanes, as well as potential energy storage from renewable energy many decades down the line. And I think the transmission lines and smart grids were already mentioned, but that's going to be important. And that's going to be a long, drawn out process to really figure out how we upgrade our energy and electricity system. So that's important.
Yeah. And then I'll add to that there's $7.5 billion in there for a network of electric vehicle chargers that will span nationwide. I don't think anyone thinks that will be sufficient to totally, you know, transition the fleet of vehicles in the U.S. to electric, but definitely a great first step, as well as another $5 billion for zero emission buses, which includes electric school buses. No word on whether they'll actually start putting seatbelts in those school buses, but they'll at least be electric.
One of my main takeaways from this, Mike, is that despite the fact that we keep talking about infrastructure as roads and bridges, this actually represents what infrastructure is. It's connectivity, it's electricity, and it's sort of like, it's not just roads. I'm sure there's a ton in here for roads and bridges, as you mentioned, Mike, $110 billion, but it's so much more than that. I just wish they'd included my childcare.
For sure. No, but it is. It's like access to the essentials of life, right? We haven't mentioned this yet, but there's $55 billion in there to eliminate every lead pipe across the US.
Yeah.
Plus another $48 billion for other water infrastructure improvements, including things like cleanup around industrial sites.
That seems important. So I've been trying to contextualize this. Like, is this the most significant piece of climate related? It's not a climate bill, but like, is this the most significant piece of climate related legislation in the United States since, like, you know, the Clean Air Act or something?
What have you landed on as you've been asking that question?
I think it's certainly the most significant since I have been following Congress, which is, you know, in the last couple of decades. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the fact that there was bipartisan, you know, in the House and Senate sort of support for this stuff, which included so much stuff that is tied directly back to climate change, like whether or not members of one party talk about the words climate change or not, like this is a pretty significant investment in dealing with the problems of today and preparing for tomorrow. So I'm here for it.
Yeah, I think that's a testament both to, you know, when Biden took office, he called it a whole of government approach to tackling climate change. You know, a testament to how even in this bill that's not necessarily climate focused and is rightly seen as insufficient, there are a number of really meaningful climate investments happening. Also a testament to, I think, how little Congress has gotten done in the last, call it 8 years, 10 years before Biden came in. So there's that as well.
Since that election night meeting in 2008, when Barack Obama got elected and they decided to stop everything every part of his agenda.
The first half of Obama's first term, we had
healthcare.
Really significant majorities in both houses, and you had one of the most productive Congresses in all of history. But you know, after that, it got tougher. You know, I do think this is a huge deal, and I think on a human level, you know, there were some trade-offs here where you look at the $110 billion in roads and bridges. There were groups that were not that thrilled about the fact that we are continuing to enable transportation via personal vehicle, right? And making that easier, because that is a major contributor to our carbon emissions in the US. That being said, this will make life better pretty quickly for basically every community in America.
And yeah, that's ultimately aren't we all going to drive electric vehicles pretty soon anyways?
Right. And so, yeah, supporting that transition obviously helps as well. But you know, the fact that this is really targeted at just improving people's lives, like, you know, improving, making those conversations around the kitchen table easier, making your commute a little easier, seeing and feeling the progress, you know, having clean drinking water in communities that don't, is what this bill is all about. And I think it will help the communities the most that need it the most, which is part of why you had the Congressional Black Caucus being so supportive of this.
Yeah.
I do think that you're not going to hear, like, in part because this was passed at like 11:30 PM on Friday night, but also because of the overall just context we've been in of the two bills and the one getting cut down and all the back and forth and sausage making in Congress, like you won't hear as much of a victory lap as I think you normally would around a historic $1.2 trillion bill passing, right? The stimulus in 2009 was like $800 billion.
Yeah.
So you're seeing, you know, what, 50% larger than that. I don't think you're seeing nearly as much fanfare. And on one level, it's a bit of a self-own that Democrats can't celebrate this win like on its own in a vacuum. But I also don't think you could have done this sequentially, you know, introducing infrastructure first, then Build Back Better, and still had a chance to get it all done. You know, we'll see what happens with Build Back Better. I think there is more hope than there's been in a while, but this was sort of the only way to pass the entire agenda.
And maybe that's what they're waiting for, right? Because think about it. If they pass the COVID recovery bill, the infrastructure bill, and the Build Back Better Act all in the first year of Biden's presidency, they kind of have a whole heck of a lot to talk about on the campaign trail next year.
It's high risk, high reward, right?
Yeah, it is. Any final takeaways, James, on the infrastructure bill?
Yeah, I mean, I think it, as you guys have mentioned, it's a great step forward. I think we're also looking for the Build Back Better package to come through. That will be a major step forward for climate. I mean, you're talking about the infrastructure bill being good on climate. It is great, but we really need to get the Build Back Better package through.
James, could you share a little bit about like what the climate provisions are in the Build Back Better Act that are most exciting and most meaningful?
Yeah, I have a few here. There's a lot of tax incentives, you know, and there's a lot of debate on what has gone in and out. I'm not up to date in the last week or so, so I apologize on that.
You've been a little busy.
So, I mean, one thing that my group has been obviously most focused and, well, one of the things that we've been most excited about is fee on methane. So there's potentially going to be a fee on companies producing oil and gas in the United States based on their emissions rates that would then tax them and hopefully reduce their methane emissions. You know, you could think of it as a carbon tax, but specifically for methane. And then that will raise more money to go to other climate provisions to be determined. Also, some work on air quality monitoring that's going to be added. There's another $5 billion towards kind of a race to the top, what's called a race to the top grant program, and then generally industrial decarbonization grants. There's a lot of tax incentives. There's about $300 billion towards tax incentives. See some of the most exciting things on there. There's some for clean hydrogen, some for more for transmission grid as well, some for carbon capture and storage, and then tech neutral credit multiplier for new clean energy technologies. Those are a few things that we've been looking at.
That's great. And really appreciate the call outs in both bills of the methane provisions. Like I had no idea about the focus on methane in either one. And it's, I think it's one, just a great teaser for what we'll talk about in a little bit, but also I think just highlights how like this odorless, colorless gas becomes like an odorless, colorless provision in some of these bills and doesn't get the airtime of some of the other headlines that that it should.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's do a quick update on the economy, because this is a thread that we've been following, obviously, on News and Brews, and I think we'll continue to. But on Friday of this past week, the October jobs report came out. The expectation was for 450,000 jobs gained, but we actually saw 531,000 jobs added, and the unemployment rate dropped to 4.6%, which is the lowest since the start of the pandemic.
My Twitter feed was all about the under 5%. And the president was talking about this, and it was, that was definitely a talking point that made the rounds probably from the DNC.
Yep. Yep. You also saw wages continue to rise. They're up now 4.9% year over year. So, you know, high level, we're still down 4.2 million jobs from February, 2020 pre-pandemic. But September had been a little slower, and there's a, this was like really encouraging across the board. This is a sign that the recovery could continue to accelerate as we get past the Delta surge and, you know, into the economy being more fully reopened.
And the vaccine mandates coming into effect.
Vaccine mandates, right?
You know, boosters. Along. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And to back up slightly, you know, the things that we want to see in the economy are healthy growth and low inflation. Right. That is essentially the mandate of the Federal Reserve is maximum employment and stable prices. That's, you know, what we hear in the concerns about stagflation is not being able to meet either of those conditions and kind of getting into this spiral. So this jobs report is really encouraging on the growth side.
Yeah.
On the inflation side, you saw the Fed last week put out their policy statement for November, essentially moderating their own level of confidence on inflation. So they had previously said that the drivers of inflation are quote unquote transitory. They now say they are quote expected to be transitory, end quote. That's basically Fed speak for the shrug emoji. and just, I think them acknowledging some humility in really fully understanding what is actually driving the inflation we're seeing and you know what could make it get worse. Also last week, the Fed announced that it will start to slow down its purchases of bonds, which is essentially pumping cash into the financial system. And they'll start that this month. So at this point, the Fed has been buying about $120 billion worth of bonds each month, split between treasury and mortgage-backed securities. It will slow that down by $15 billion a month starting now. And this is like a good reminder of how many tools the Fed still has to push back against inflation. So if they reduce their bond purchases by the same amount each month, $15 billion less each month, they'll end the purchases altogether next June. Then if it still looks like we're at risk for accelerating inflation, they can start thinking about raising interest rates at that point. But even before they start considering an interest rate hike, they have, you know, $120 billion per month of stimulus that they're pumping into the financial system that they can pull out.
All right. Keyword stimulus. So this purchase of the bonds was something they were doing to like jumpstart the economy. And now that the economy is jumpstarted, they're pulling back.
Exactly. Exactly. And so I think both on the growth side and the inflation side, we had sort of an encouraging week for the economic outlook, and we'll see where it goes from here.
You know, where in the world didn't have an encouraging week?
Where?
Ethiopia. Ethiopia had a really, really bad week and quite frankly has had a very bad year. And so last Tuesday, the Ethiopian government led by Prime Minister and Nobel Peace Prize winner Abiy Ahmed declared a 6-month state of emergency as anti-government armed forces approached the capital, Addis Ababa. On Thursday then, the U.S. Embassy basically said that all non-essential personnel can leave. That's essentially the diplomatic speak for, you know, it's all going to shit. On Friday, I started getting multiple, like, what the heck is going on in Ethiopia messages across all platforms. And so I thought it would be kind of useful to just briefly go over what's going on there. And unfortunately, I'm going to have to take folks on a little bit of a journey to do this. So if you'll indulge me.
You say unfortunately, but like, I get so excited, even though it's a really sad story. Like, I'm so excited to go on this journey with you.
Well, I'm glad that you're here. And James also has significant experience in the Horn of Africa. You know, would love his corrections on my portrayal of recent history here. But essentially, we have to go back to at least the Cold War to really understand what happened this week. So in the 70s and 80s, Ethiopia was ruled by a Soviet-backed Marxist group known as the Derg. And anybody who's spent any time in Ethiopia knows that the Derg is a very bad word. They were really, really bad. They took over from the last emperor of Ethiopia, Haile Selassie, which is another name that you hear a lot. They were authoritarian in the extreme. Who knows how many people were killed by their death squads. And they basically, if there was any dissent, they just were notorious worldwide for quashing that dissent very quickly. Regardless, the Ethiopian people, in my own personal experience and across history, have shown to be incredibly resilient. This is one of the only countries, if not the only country on the continent of Africa, that was never fully colonized by an outside entity. Hmm. And so dissent during the Derg did flourish. And one of the insurgent groups that started to gain traction was in the northern Tigray region. And it was known as the TPLF, or the Tigray People's Liberation Front. And remember TPLF, because we'll come back to that. So again, that was 70s and 80s, you know, some dissent growing in outside of Addis Ababa. Fast forward to 1991, the Iron Curtain has fallen and a TPF-led coalition of anti-Derg forces overthrew the Marxist Derg regime. And that coalition, known as the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, or EPRDF, Ethiopians love them some good acronyms, would essentially govern Ethiopia until 2018. Including the times when James and I were traipsing through Ethiopia. So along the way, the EPRDF-led Ethiopian government engaged in a war with Eritrea that lasted officially from 1998 to 2018, when in Ethiopia, a non-Tigrinya person swept into power. That's Abiy Ahmed. So in 2018, there was a lot of kind of interest in Ethiopia because this was a new government. He was promising a bunch of reforms and anti-corruption and modernizing the economy. And I remember being in Ethiopia and not having my cell phone work in places where, you know, I could go to Somalia or rural South Sudan and my cell phone would work better than in some neighborhoods of Addis Ababa. And that was a deliberate choice, right, by the EPRDF-led Ethiopian government before Abiy. So among his first acts as prime minister was to reach out to Eritrea and to abolish the EPRDF as a ruling coalition. In its place, he created the Prosperity Party, focused on reforming, quote unquote, the Ethiopian government and the economy. And it was really, he was doing this at breakneck speed. It was like every week there was a new announcement about some reform. The TPLF, again, once dominant in Ethiopian politics, refused to join the Prosperity Party. So the TPLF is now marginalized.
So just to put the acronyms in context, the EPRDF had been the ruling party pre Abiy Ahmed coming in,
which included the TPLF,
which included and was initially led by the TPLF.
Yes. Yeah.
Abiy comes in, basically outlaws the EPRDF because they've been doing all this bad stuff, creates this new space for them to exist in that's more reform minded. But the TPLF says, we're not going to be a part of that.
Yeah. And he was part of the previous government. He like mm-hmm. made his way up through the intelligence services and sort of was part of it. And then basically as soon as he came into power, unbeknownst to a lot of international observers who were super excited about him, was sort of continually marginalizing the Tigrinya. Hmm. So ultimately he reached out to Eritrea as one of his first acts. And for the ultimate peace agreement that Ethiopia and Eritrea signed, Abiy Ahmed would go on to win the Nobel Peace Prize, which we can have a different discussion about this a different day, but at the time it seemed warranted. I mean, he brought a 20-year war with the neighbor to an end, and he did so rapidly and we thought for good reasons. Well,
you mentioned on a past episode that when he received the Nobel Peace Prize, he like refused to take questions from reporters, and that was like a clear red flag.
Initial warning sign that some people saw. I'm not going to claim that I saw it, but you know, there was certainly some warning signs earlier on. Like a lot of things, it's like you hope for the best and you want the best, and so sometimes you don't see what's right in front of you. And so what was right in front of you on U.S. election day in the United States, so as a lot of people were celebrating or not celebrating the election of Joe Biden, Abiy Ahmed was launching an offensive in Tigray. Ostensibly in response to a TPLF attack on a military base, which the TPLF did attack a military base. And so he was responding to that. By most accounts, this offensive was the result of Abiy basically losing patience in his quest to marginalize the power of the Tigrinyans. And I will say, I'm trying to present this in a very even way, because I think there's not a clear good guy, bad guy situation. There rarely is in situations of conflict. And so, and as I'll talk about in a second, I mean, there's really no good guys in this, and there's just a bunch of bad guys doing really bad things. Over the last year, things have been really bad in Tigray, especially for civilians that live there. Human rights violations on all sides, Eritrean forces aiding Abiy's forces across the border. So this sort of former adversary was now sending their planes over to bomb innocent civilians, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Humanitarian aid groups had more access to Afghanistan than they did to people in Tigray. Really, really devastating.
Wow.
So what's essentially happening now, so again, fast forward to the last couple of weeks, is that Abiy, despite the assistance of their former sworn enemy, Eritrea, has basically all but lost the battle for Tigray. And now, not only has he lost the battle, the TPLF is advancing on Addis Ababa. So they've left Tigray and they're marching towards the capital, Addis Ababa. Not only that, on Friday, the TPLF banded together with 8 other armed groups opposed to the Abiy government. So who knows how this ends, but today, Ethiopia finds itself on the precipice of basically all-out war. So,
and what are the TPLF's stated goals? Are they a separatist movement, or are they trying to retake control of the central government?
It's a bit unclear. It's like anti-government at the moment, but it's unclear whether they're trying to take over the government like they used to have control over the government, or mm-hmm. whether this is like a secessionist movement. It's unclear right now.
Well, banding together with the 8 other groups would suggest that they may have more centralized ambitions.
Yeah, it could be, or it just could be like we unite against a common enemy. This happened in South Sudan, you know, around the before the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. Like, you know, South Sudanese tribes didn't necessarily get along with one another, but they were sort of unified in their opposition to the Bashir-led, you know, Sudan. The hard situation here is that very few people are able to access Ethiopia right now. Like, they're keeping everybody out. So information is really scarce. So that's what's going on in Ethiopia. My heart and thoughts go out to Ethiopian friends still there.
For sure. And I will say that because a lot of our listeners are in the US, seeing some of the reports of what has happened, not just in the last week, but over the last several months and years in Tigray, is reminiscent, I think, of some of the self-defeating aspects of the war on terror, that, you know, the human rights violations, the heavy-handedness, the lack of empathy and thought for civilians living in this zone has done nothing but strengthen, and that's on the part of Abiy and the central government, has done nothing but been a recruiting tool for the forces opposed to him.
Yeah. Again, it's really complicated. I've omitted a ton of nuance from this, and as much as I tried to be even, I'm sure some listeners will take issue, and as they should, with my presentation. But I think for those really interested in like the nitty gritty details of this, there was a really excellent piece in the Georgetown Journal of International Affairs earlier this year by Richard Reed, which we will link in the show notes. With that, Mike, I think we should get into our main story.
Let's do it.
So our main story, which we have our friend James Cerrito here to talk about, is COP26. And so COP, for those that don't know, stands for Conference of the Parties, which in real people terms refers to all the countries who signed on to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, or the UNFCCC. That was signed way back in 1992 in Rio de Janeiro. And the first Conference of Parties to the Treaty, or COP, was held not too far from where James is right now, in Bonn, Germany, in 1995. And so if people are like, what is this COP thing? Why are we talking about it all of a sudden? It's like, well, you've actually heard of it before. Like, you've heard of the Kyoto Protocol? Well, that was actually COP3. You heard of the Paris Climate Deal? That was actually COP21.
This is so interesting. Like, this is essentially an institution with like as much staying power and maybe more impact than the WTO, but I had never heard COP as a phrase until this year.
So COP1 was actually held in Berlin, Errol. I just want to,
Oh, no kidding.
It was in Berlin. Yeah.
Fact check.
Germany has played a big role in COP history. They've held a lot of different COPs over the years.
And the secretariat for the UNFCCC is in Germany, I think, still in either Bonn or Berlin or someplace like that. So now we're basically at COP26, which is 5-ish years after the Paris Agreement was signed. And since we tend to like orderly numbers like 5, it seems like a good chance to check in on progress. So to help us unpack COP26 and advise on the proper pronunciation of methane, which our British friends erroneously call methane, is James Torito. So thanks again for joining us, James.
Well, thanks for having me. And I'm glad I can share my thoughts on the first week of COP. So COP is a 2-week conference, and I was in attendance for the first week, and I'm glad to have only been there for 1 week. It's nonstop. It really is. It's very tiring. A lot of activity going on.
What was it like being there?
We spent most of our days inside the conference center and didn't really get much sunlight, as you can imagine. Probably got there around 8:30 every morning, waited in line for about 1 to 2 hours to get in. The lines were pretty notorious this year. And then we left around 6 p.m. and would go out and, you know, have other meetings or dinners with people. Outside, you had protesters. So you might have heard this weekend there were hundreds of thousands of protesters in the streets of Glasgow on Saturday, led by Greta Thunberg and then many other climate groups calling for more progress. You know, there's a lot of activity. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of very, very important people, you know, particularly on the first 2 days of COP. this year was when the leader summits were occurring. So you had heads of state from many different countries. Biden was there. Trudeau was there. A lot of EU leaders were there. You had lots of heads of state, lots of security, lots of delegations of ministers in attendance. I have such bad facial recognition that I couldn't see anyone. Or even if I saw someone. But my colleague gave John Kerry a fist bump while he was walking down the hall with him. And
you said, wouldn't have recognized John Kerry?
James? I would have recognized John Kerry. I would have recognized John Kerry because he towers over everyone. He's like 7 feet tall. I don't know.
And for those of us who have a New Hampshire background, he looks like the old man in the mountain.
He does.
It's really, you know, the best way to think about it is that it really is a negotiation mostly. You know, governments from around the world send delegations, and everyone there is to really debate and discuss the fine points of documents that, you know, everyone is going to agree to. So unlike most conferences you would go to, you know, the speaking events aren't the main event. You know, we go to conferences and we think about what, you know, speaking events we want to go to. But what's happening is there's a lot of back rooms, and I mean, there's just negotiation rooms where all sorts of topics are being discussed. Each day has a particular theme, and the delegations just go into the rooms and discuss kind of how to move forward on certain things.
So what were some of the big things that were being negotiated this year?
Yeah, so a lot of news events came from the first 2 days during the Leader Summit, and you probably heard about those. Three, maybe let's say four of the big things that really came out of this COP, and maybe I'll be a little bit biased, but I'll put methane first.
Dude, it was huge. It was all over the news. And I was like, James, you made it, man. It's the pinnacle.
Yeah, it was a pretty big deal. I mean, the Global Methane Pledge was a really impressive push forward. This was the first time methane has really been highlighted as a major global warming pollutant. Organizations like mine, the Clean Air Task Force, have been talking about it for a while, but it's never been given center stage.
What's its contribution, as a quick aside, because I want to get to the other highlights, but like, what's methane's contribution to climate change?
So the IPCC's sixth assessment report that just came out in September said that methane contributes about 50% to the global warming we're seeing today.
50.
Wow.
50. Yeah. And the reason for this is it's a super pollutant. It's over 80 times more powerful than carbon dioxide on a 10-year period. It has a short half-life, unlike carbon dioxide. So it only lasts in the atmosphere for about 12 years. Carbon dioxide lasts for hundreds. And so we've seen enormous amounts of methane growth in the atmosphere over the last two decades or so. It's been steadily climbing for the last five decades, but that has significantly increased since about the mid-2000s, somewhat coinciding with the fracking boom in the United States. Not all of it is coming from the oil and gas industry. Some of it's also coming from livestock. And when I say that, I mean the increase of methane over the last two decades. It's coming from both oil and gas as well as livestock.
So a super pollutant, that's like the opposite of Captain Planet.
Yeah. It'll be Captain Planet's
tonight. but it's like there had to be a bad guy in the Captain Planet, you know, cartoons, right?
The Captain Planet bad guys are fantastic. We could do a whole episode on this. The main one's name was Loot and Plunder.
Was there a methane related one?
There was one that was like half pig too. So probably. I had no idea that this was on the order of 50% of the climate impact we're seeing. And from what I've heard you say in other interviews, James, it sounds like it's also where things like shifting off of oil consumption for transportation or coal for electric power require real behavioral shifts on a massive scale. So much of the methane is just being kind of leaked for convenience or, you know, flared for economic reasons that are hyper local or hyper company specific, that it actually wouldn't require nearly as much of a massive scale behavior shift to fix the problem. Is that kind of the argument you're making?
Yeah. So the International Energy Agency says that 75% of emissions, particularly in the oil and gas industry, can be reduced at zero to marginal costs to the company. And that's a significant chunk of the methane emissions that we see today. We see methane methane in the oil and gas industry as the lowest hanging fruit. That 75% could represent a significant amount of the total methane emissions reductions that we have set out in this global methane pledge over the next decade.
Why don't companies do something about it?
You know, unfortunately, we've been allowing companies to self-regulate for a long time. And to some extent, it's seen as a waste product. You know, there's been an increase in gas as a product. So, you know, methane is natural gas. Methane is the main component of natural gas. We often use natural gas in our homes for cooking and heating. But it's also coincides and can be found with oil production. And so when you're a company that's just producing oil, you often don't make any plans to capture the gas that's associated with that oil. And that's a lot of gas. And often they just vent it into the air.
I want to talk about the Clean Air Task Force a little bit, James, because what was the role of your organization in that methane pledge? And then I want to talk about sort of the organization more broadly.
Sure. So we played a pretty critical role in the methane pledge behind the scenes. You know, I mean, this obviously couldn't have happened with any of the political actors and the willingness to really push it forward. I mean, the leadership from the White House, the EU, and even the COP presidency was astounding on this and their interest in really taking up this issue. But the Clean Air Task Force, what we did behind the scenes was help think about, you know, what would an agreement or what would a plan for tackling methane emissions on a global scale look like? And what will we need to get there? There's also questions of, you know, should something include just the energy sector? Should it include livestock emissions as well? And so those were the kind of questions we helped to address. In the end, we also were calling countries that we've been working with for a long time and then getting those countries to call other countries to sign on to the pledge.
And so what is the pledge going to do?
So the pledge is a commitment for global reduction of methane emissions by 30%. Really, it's the starting gun, right? This is going to give us and everyone working on methane emissions reduction to talk and work with governments and really push forward regulations on reducing methane emissions. So it creates the political space for countries to really move forward on this. It will also draw attention. I mean, so much of my work in the EU over the last year has been trying to get, you know, media and politicians and just to think about why we need regulations on methane emissions. You know, I think prior to this COP, you know, we were trying to convince people why methane is so important. And I think this pledge has shown that it is. And so that's going to make our work easier. It's going to make anyone else's work on methane easier. Not only that, in addition to the pledge, and just as important, is that several philanthropic organizations came together and announced $330 million to create a hub to finance methane emissions reduction. This is more money than has ever put into methane before by a factor of at least 10. This is a significant number, a significant contribution to the fight.
And so you talked about the work that you're doing across the continent. Talk a little bit about that work. I mean, I envision James the Mountain Man in a van through like the mountains of Switzerland and Italy, telling farmers and, you know, whatever that they have you know, should reduce their emissions. But like, what do you do? You're headed on a trip tomorrow. So like, for example, don't give it away. What do you do?
So I have a special infrared camera that can document and observe methane because, you know, as Mike said, methane is invisible and odorless. You can't see it. And you can only smell it in your homes because it's been treated with a special chemical that allows you to smell it. So the camera can visualize emissions. And what I do is I drive around Europe to oil and gas facilities. As much as, you know, I think everyone would love to see me go video cow farts and cow burps, I'm not doing that. Gas comes out of the cow's mouth, not the other side. So,
duly noted.
That's the most disappointing thing we've talked about on this show so far.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, so I'm just running around Europe in a van with an expensive camera that I go around and look at oil and gas facilities uninvited from the companies.
You're shooting the methane.
I'm shooting it, yeah.
Americans can appreciate that.
How do you know where to go?
I spent a lot of time researching the oil and gas industry in Europe. I've got a lot of maps on my computer. I've Googled, you know, I like have built out Google Maps with the geo coordinates of like all the locations of these oil and gas facilities. And I've also coordinated closely with a lot of activists on the ground across all these countries. So in a lot of countries, they also know where a lot of the oil and gas facilities are, particularly like production areas where there are oil wells and gas wells. Some of the larger facilities I can find from association websites, but it's taken a lot of sleuthing and data kind of collection and mapping.
Any fun stories from your traipsing across Europe? For viewers, he just put his head in his hands.
I mean, you know, we could spend the next 2 hours talking about fun stories. I've even been starting to write a lot of my stories down because I don't want to forget them. I mean,
cool. You know, come back when you're promoting your book for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Let me think about some good ones. I was in southern Italy in Basilicata, which is, you know, as many people would, well, some people might know, this is largely mafia controlled territory. And I was told by the local activist groups that I shouldn't go out around by myself, but it just so happened that the week before, the Italian government in early April decided to lock everything down and said that no one could leave. I still went into the country because I was traveling by van and was doing, you know, had a lot of work documentation. But the group of activists that I was going to meet up with who were going to show me around the area and travel with me, they couldn't risk doing it. And so I'm walking around in a farm with this really expensive camera and looking at this facility next to the farm. And some farmer comes up yelling at me in Italian. And I had no clue what he was saying. He was really angry. And so I called my contact in Rome. We've been consulting with, and he started to translate the whole conversation on speakerphone. Apparently somebody had driven into the farmer's field and ruined a bunch of his crops. And as I walked over there, I'm looking at the field, and the gas company had put in a metering station, something to kind of, I guess, do some test sampling of the facility in the middle of his field. And they just like wrecked about 20 by 20 square meters of his farm and didn't tell him. And then it was clear because I just saw that the tracks go straight into the facility. And so the farmer, despite the fact that we told him, you know, we're on his side and we're fighting against the gas company, was pretty irate and just thought that I had worked with a gas company. And so I didn't know, you know, he kind of threatened us a little bit. And I was like, all right, I'm gonna get out of here. And so I rushed back to the van and kind of drove out. He sort of followed me in his tractor as I was walking back to the van. And then I got into the van and just drove straight, even though I had no clue where I was going. I was like, there's no way I'm driving back down this small road because I don't know if the farmer has a gun in his tractor or anything.
Honestly. Or friends.
Yeah. So that was fun. But
where all have you been across Europe?
So I've been, over the last 6 months, I've been to 12 different countries. I've been to Italy, traveled around Germany. I've been to Czech, Austria, Hungary, Slovakia, Romania, Netherlands, France, Belgium, and Poland as well. And then a month before the COP conference, I spent 3 weeks traveling around the UK to document emissions and raise the profile of methane in the host nation's country.
Wow, that's amazing. And you said you're going back on the road tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow's trip's going to be a little bit easier. I'm staying in Germany and I'm only traveling for 3 days. So I'm going to some oil production fields in Germany. There's a little bit of oil production in Germany, not a ton. And I'm doing some filming with one of the largest TV stations in Germany. They're based out of Munich. And I did some filming with them before. So I'm going to go out on the road with them for a few more days.
So I just have one last question. And we talked about this last week a little bit around the G20 summit and around a lot of these international summits of countries coming together, is that you can make pledges and you can make commitments, but it's not really binding in most cases unless you have action at the national level, at the legislative level. So what will you really be looking for following up on the Global Methane Pledge as indicators of success and progress against the methane problem?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you know, I'd say that about every international agreement too. Like, I mean, international agreements are generally non-binding in the end, right? So what we want to see and what we're going to have to do, when I look at the map of countries that have signed the pledge, you know, I look at a lot of work ahead, you know, for our organization and for everyone else. What we want to see are new regulations passed to reduce emissions. There are clear processes and practices that can be introduced to reduce emissions. Those are known, and we have the technologies to do it. So we need action from countries. And we're already working with many countries that are doing this. So Colombia is going to be introducing some new regulations on methane in the next month. We're working with Ecuador and Argentina, Mexico. Even a few years ago, we've been working with them closely. They introduced some really good regulations. Then once you have the regulations, you need to have to work on enforcement, right? The enforcement of regulations are really the next step. And that's where we are in the US as well. And we need tighter regulations in the US, but we also need enforcement as well. Yeah, I think a few things. The commitments are great. And then action with regulations is the next step. We're hoping that we're going to be able to showcase countries over the next year, 2 years, 3 years that really start to take action. The EU is currently passing regulation and we'll introduce it next month to reduce methane emissions across the EU. And so we've been tightly engaged on that.
Excellent. Just want to say, you know, this may be the healthy pour of scotch that I'm now in on this episode talking, but the clarity of purpose that you have and the case that you have made for methane as the lowest hanging fruit, as a real point of leverage in the fight against climate change, as well as the follow-up and the action that you've taken on a real ongoing basis against it, is just staggeringly impressive. So thank you so much for everything you're doing, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. And I want to add one more point. You know, methane, like I said before, methane has a short half-life. So if in the next 5 to 10 years, we can reduce methane emissions, we can actually slow the growth of warming and start to really slow the curve over the next 2 to 3 decades. With carbon, we can't really do that. The amount of carbon that we release in the atmosphere today, yesterday, next year, that's going to be there for hundreds of years until we decide to pull it out, or until we figure out the technology to pull it out. With methane, it will decompose, and then its impact on warming slows down as well. So it's stuff we can see in our lifetimes. That's the important thing.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot to be encouraged about by the pledge. And I think, James, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, you have quite a bit of work ahead of you to make sure that people stick to that. And hopefully, as you said, the pledge is helpful to you. You're not like the thorn in the side. You're just like, hey, I'm here because your country, you know, committed to doing this 30% reduction, and here's how you do it. And it, oh, by the way, it's not going to cost you anything, and it's, you know, going to have a huge impact. So I wish you the best of luck, man. I think what you're doing is really important. We'll link to the Clean Air Task Force in the show notes. And as Mike said, look forward to having you back on when you publish that methane memoir.
Yeah, you'll have to call it methane.
Methane.
I think an even better title I have now is the International Methane Hunter.
Ooh, there you go. Well, listen, thanks again. And thanks everyone for listening. We'll be back here next week.
And once again, we fixed it.
Oh yeah, I forgot. Well, actually we didn't. I think James fixed it.
James is actually fixing it. You know, as much as one can with consistent, tireless dedication over years, almost as much as a single podcast episode, you know?
Excellent. Well, thanks everyone.
News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Errol Yabuke. Our guest today was James Torito. Our producer is Alana Nevins. This episode was recorded Monday, November 8th, 2021 at noon Eastern Time. We've got new episodes available each Wednesday on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.